welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. I want to thank our underwriter, James Verdonic. He's an attorney with Warden Smith, PA of Raleigh, North Carolina. And James became an underwriter this year, and he's been on the program several times. And his website is gatewaycapitalx.com. That's GATEWAYCAPITALX, as in x-ray.com. Now, Focus on Business Radio is dedicated to maximizing your business success through interviews with subject matter experts, information on critical aspects of starting and doing business, and providing insights through shared success stories. Now, no two businesses are exactly alike, but successful businesses share common characteristics, and those are the characteristics that we explore in each program. I am personally an entrepreneur, a small business owner for over 15 years, an author and a columnist, and a subject matter expert on business change processes and systems, especially in the financial and accounting, human resources, operations, and funding aspects of the business. I built my business from scratch in 2002 to a recognized resource for entrepreneurs, business startups, and government contractors in 46 states, Canada, and Mexico. So I'm walking the walk and talking the talk and bringing the guests in to help us explore these topics. And so my guest today is Doug Colvard with Fourscore. I always want to say Square, but it's Fourscore Law. And Doug has been with Fourscore since, well, he joined the firm this year. And he is primarily practicing corporate and business law. He has worked previously in financial services industry, focusing primarily on derivatives and prime brokerage space before joining Fourscore. Prior to his legal career, and yes, lawyers sometimes have careers before they become lawyers, Doug worked at a venture-backed startup and in investment banking, and he was also an educational consultant. He currently advises and assists organizations from startups, middle market companies, and multinational corporations across a broad range of industries, including finance, technology, healthcare, manufacturing, advertising, and software, to name just a few. Doug also regularly assists closely held businesses on a variety of topics, including the business formation and organization of businesses. Now, Fourscore Business Law, it provides legal services, including angel and venture fundraising, merger and acquisition, startup counseling, business formation, intellectual property, employment relationships, and real estate. Their website is Fourscore Law. Their social media Twitter handle is at Fourscore Law. They're on LinkedIn under Fourscore Law, and they're also on Facebook under Fourscore Law. Doug, thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So talk about your practice, and you've joined Fourscore this year, and what made you make the transition to Fourscore, and what is Fourscore all about, and what are you doing right now? Just spill the beans.
Yeah, so Fourscore Law does three primary things, which you kind of already hit the notes on, which are, one is we advise a lot of early stage startup companies and do a lot of venture-backed financing work. So mostly that is, you know, folks who are looking to raise money or maybe have raised money and are looking you know, to kind of restructure what they're doing. In that regard, we also represent a handful of institutional investors. So that could be your traditional kind of VCs or private equity funds or angel investors, folks like that.
So real quick, give the difference to the audience between a private equity fund and ventures.
So it really depends on who you're talking to.
See, I figured you were going to say that. So,
but traditionally, like, venture capital funds are, it is a fund that's set up through professional investors who solicit outside money from, it could be your teacher's pension fund, it could be, you know,
high net worth individuals,
a really, you know, high net worth individual, etc. And basically what they do is they solicit individuals' money or to invest in those companies, and they're typically targeted to investing in companies themselves. And those are purely typically kind of equity investments. And what I mean by that is, you know, think of your traditional kind of two kids in a garage. They've got a cool idea, and they need $500,000 to get started. Your venture capital fund is going to, you know, come in there, and they're going to actually write a $500,000 check in exchange for
51% of the company.
Right, or whatever they want to do. Right. And it can be as simple as that. It can be as complicated as, they also want management rights, board rights, rights to invest in future rounds, etc. Private equity funds are sometimes a little bit different into that they could be making equity investments, but they also are typically much heavier players in the kind of M&A space. So they
more
might
established,
be,
larger entities, larger deals.
Right. And so it could be, a private equity fund, taking an activist position in Staples and, becoming a majority owner in that company and then turning it around from the inside. It could be soliciting and acquiring a company. But most of the time, private equity funds are not going to, they're in the business of kind of buying and selling companies. Whereas to venture capital firms,
they're buying a fractional interest.
Typically, yes. Yeah. And so that's pretty much kind of the difference between the two of that. Does that?
That helps.
Yep. So I think, when you ask about our practice, one thing that is kind of complementary to that is we do a handful of and a number of kind of M&A transactions. So, the push on that is basically most of our companies will either become the acquired or the acquirer themselves. Right. So either they will grow by acquiring subsidiary or smaller companies, or, a lot of them will be pushed to an acquisition of your Googles, your Facebooks, your et cetera. And so those are the two primary things that we do. The third one is just kind of a general outside in-house counsel role. So it could be
the
anywhere
day-to-day
from
transactional business.
Yeah. And so it could be, hey, I need help with an employment agreement. Hey, I need, you to take a look at this licensing agreement, try and help us out. And, and I think that that's always kind of an important service to provide to your clients, just so that, especially with the companies we deal with, they might be super, have a brilliant product, brilliant thing, but then they come to you and they're like, hey, how do I hire somebody?
Well, and it's not only that, but it's when you're looking down that chain of you want to raise funds or you want to be acquired or you want to acquire, having the legal housekeeping and the business housekeeping in order when it comes along makes it much easier to start raising those funds and doing all that kind of thing.
Yeah, so what a lot of what we see is what we're trying to do is, set up like a strong foundation to the business that allows them to, as the business grows, as it develops, that allows it to scale up, because, if you don't and you kind of hack out all of those kind of legal needs at the outset, you have a house of cards, right? And
right.
So what happens is then, we were dealing with it, several weeks ago where it's like, a company, says, hey, I've got a term sheet with $2 million on it, and they haven't even formed their company from a legal structure yet. And so that's fine. We can deal with that.
Or they did the term sheet for an incorporated and they're really an LLC. Or they issue stock in an LLC. Or preferred stock, that was my favorite one. Someone was issuing preferred stock in their LLC, and there was a lot of issuances. But yeah, it's those housekeeping. It's making sure that if you long-term want to fund your business, you want to grow your business, you want to have IP that's protected, all those kind of things, that you're able to handle the legal matters and the business day-to-day matters.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the important thing to do is to recognize that, your legal structure and it allows you to kind of protect yourself individually as well, which I think, that gets a handful of folks always get themselves into problems with. Not adhering to corporate formalities or not, you know, commingling funds, doing things that, you know, unfortunately, ignorance isn't a defense whenever you're being sued.
Well, you see that, and it's like they don't form a formal corporation or an LLC, and yet there might be one person, and they're handing out a business card that says Inc. on it. You know, it's like after the name, and they've not formed the corporation. Or they form the corporation, and then they don't – we were talking before we went on air. They don't file annual reports. They don't file tax returns. They don't do all of the steps to keep the corporation valid or the entity, the LLC, valid. And then that protection that that entity could have given them is no longer there because they haven't adhered to the state rules. And I ran into – it's probably been about 5 years ago. One of the companies I met with, their company had been dissolved 7 years before in the state that they were in because they hadn't filed the annual reports. They hadn't filed all the things to keep it going. And the legal entity name had actually been given to another company, but they had been doing government contracts under that legal name of ABC Inc., let's just say. And so here's all this mess of receiving government funds as an entity that you're no longer legally have that name for, even in your state, and all of those house of card type things that, you know, ignorance wasn't a defense because then the contract right. isn't valid. All of these different things start rolling through.
I'll tell you one other thing that a lot of, you know, attorneys will probably tell you after the fact, but is important for you to bear in mind before you ever start a company, and especially when you have co-founders, is like before you set up everything, before you, you know, develop out your business plan and everything else, like if you can at the outset get very clear directives on kind of what is the breakdown of ownership, who's going to do what, you know, are you going to purely be your sales and marketing person and I'm going to be the ops and the administrative person, what does our split look like, etc., before you start getting into everything. Because what you do is you run into a lot of issues where, you know, folks have been working together for 6 months, a year, years with certain kind of expectations and obligations. And then, you know, once they bring the attorneys in, the attorneys, which is fine, but they look like, you know, the bad guys or the bad girls, right? Because it's like, oh, well, this isn't how this was working before. And, you know, it's funny because when we're consulting with clients, clients will say, yeah, you know, we've kind of told them this, but we don't want to do it that way. We want to do it another way. And so, you know, just from a relationship standpoint, if you can, you know, iron those things out before you develop out your next Facebook, Google idea, I think it's always, you know, a better approach.
Well, and it's also important, and your area of expertise is funding primarily for the business, whether that's angel funding, venture, private equity, crowdfunding, mm-hmm. and now the tokens and things. And so regardless of what type of funding you're going to have to raise, that clean up those legal structures, that housekeeping of being a valid business entity with your books in order, your legal relationships defined, really has to be cleaned up before you can go into that fundraising mode.
Right. And if you don't, then
it's
anyone who and anyone who knows what they're doing is going to make you do that.
Right.
So
and it delays the deal.
Yeah. So
a VC is not going to invest when there's a bunch of legal issues or things not clear, all those kind of things in there until everything's cleaned up.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd probably say is that you as a young entrepreneur, you don't want to get too far into the weeds too early on. And so while it is important to have like your legal framework, it's important to have your structure, have everything there. Sometimes younger entrepreneurs can get bogged down into trying to get everything perfect and everything right at the outset, and not kind of hitting the high notes on, okay, what do I really need to focus on right now? And, you know, although I have a vested interest in it, it's like, yeah, I do think that your legal needs and requirements should be at the top of that bucket. But you also should figure out, like, how are you going to sell your product? How are you going to, you know, deliver it onto the market, et cetera? you know, but you shouldn't have to be, you shouldn't be spending weeks talking about, you know, whether I should buy blue pens for the office or black pens for the office, right?
You've had and a few of those too, huh?
Yeah. So, it's important to get that understanding, right?
Right, because it's what I saw. It's your product, it's your business process, it's your plan, and it's your protection of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you define what business you're in. You get that product or that technology, which they usually love to focus on because that's where their passion is. But then the business process that goes behind it so that they can get that first customer and they can price it, they can do all those things. And then when they're getting all of that in perspective and putting the protection around it, it's great to have a product if you rush it to market and you haven't gotten a patent or any protection and you're over in China, say, manufacturing it. There's all of these things that happen. And then understanding that IP protection or software. What are you going to copyright? What are you going to treat as your platform? What are you going to allow customers to buy from you and that they own it, and defining those things that come into there so that when we go to do fundraising, whether that's traditional angels coming in, whether that's venture, private equity, whether that's tokens, it's crowdfunding, whatever we're doing, that we have something that differentiates the business and is an asset that somebody wants to invest in and says, okay, that's what my money is going towards. It's taking that product into manufacturing, into prototyping, or taking that software to market, whatever that is.
Yeah, and if you want to make your investors happy, like one of the easiest ways is getting a team of advisors around you that know what they're doing and allow you to understand when you need to make certain investments at what point, because timing is sometimes more important than exactly what you need. So, you know, to your point, it's like, you know, on IP protection, right? If I need, you know, if a client comes to me and says, hey, I want to, you know, file a process patent on, you know, my software application, and I want to, you know, do, you know, a ton of work, I'm like, that's fine. You can do that. You're going to spend $30,000, but why do you need all of that? Like, first of all, it's pretty unlikely that you actually get that patent. Second of all, like, I don't know if that's the best way to spend your legal spend right now. Like, maybe what you should do is really get your legal docs in line. And then once you have something that's a valuable, tangible product, or you think it's a valuable tangible process, then let's go down that path. But, you know, maybe you're better off spending more, you know, spend or money or investments on, you know, having a good, purely kind of business advisor, consulting advisor, right? Maybe you need more.
Is everyone listening to that?
Right. So, you know, maybe you're looking for an SBIR grant and, you know, you want to bring someone in who $1,000 with them is probably much better spent, because, you know, you could get a non-dilutive, you know, SBIR grant. And
for anyone that hasn't cut in the shows on grants before, that's Small Business Innovation Research Grant. And there's also a Small Business Technology Transfer awards that come into small businesses that are doing research. And it's sort of the early money, doesn't have to be repaid, but it funds certain aspects of your research under different rules, and that's why it's non-dilutive. The government doesn't own the IP, doesn't get repaid for it, assuming you comply and you do all the steps that you need to do. And so that's funding that's an alternative there. And if you can get a grant written for $1,000 for one of those, I want to talk to that person. But even when you're writing an SBIR, you have intellectual property issues. You need to know, what do you have to do? What do you have to report? Is it going to be patented? Did you get the patent first? You're going to reduce it to practice. You have to do the accounting. You have to do the compliance. You have to do the business side. And frequently, that's the more challenging side for any of the early stage businesses. And I'm going to say for some businesses that are around 10 years and haven't really gotten traction, and they've been in the SBIR, SDTR world, they need matching funds, or they need funds to commercialize, all of those kind of things. And so the business aspect along with the technology aspect is what has to be there if we're going to raise funds. And crowdfunding's the hot thing. We were talking again before we went on air, how many people I'm getting calls from about doing crowdfunding and not fully understanding what those requirements are. So if NC PACES Act comes in and I want to raise $2 million, well, you can raise $2 million if you're within North Carolina, you're a North Carolina business, you have audited financial statements or at least reviewed financial statements. If you don't have all those check boxes, it really reduces your options for what kind of funding you can do and how much you can raise.
Yeah, and I mean, what I would say is that there are, like we were talking earlier, there are many different ways that you can fund a business, right?
Let's walk through some of them.
So, you know, the first ones, which are probably your more traditional ways, is just your friends and family or your debt, right? And so...
the most common investors, Visa, MasterCard, and Discover, and American Express.
Exactly. Or your local bank branch, right? Is you can go out to a local bank branch, you can get a small business loan. I can't guarantee what the rates will be and what the payback will be, and you might have to take a personal guarantee on your house, but actually a lot of people use that. And, you know, that's not a bad option to the extent that you are in a business that is going to have immediate funds come in. So you're going to have immediate customers, you're immediately going to generate sales, etc., right? So if I was going to...
It's truly short-term to use those options.
Right. And it could be more beneficial for you on the long run, assuming that your business thrives and takes off. So, you know...
So from a practical standpoint, I always have to say this. Assuming it and that you've done work to get it, that those assumptions have something. So you can't assume, and I can flash back to another customer, we're going to have $17 million in sales this year and they didn't have a product anywhere to be seen. So there has to be reality behind the assumptions, because a lot of people think things are going to take less time than they actually do to get something to market and get that first customer.
Right. And... you know, and the other kind of drawback to those traditional paths is normally they have traditional payback. So it's just like a mortgage, right? And, you know, you take out a $100,000 loan, you have an obligation to pay back $2,000 every month, regardless of what your sales are.
Right.
Right. And so for a lot of businesses, that doesn't work. A lot of what we'll do with businesses that maybe don't have their first paying customer for a year or two is issue convertible notes or safe notes, which are simple agreements for future equity. And we've even, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier is we've even, you know, worked on SAFTs, which are simple agreements for future tokens and for future token sales. And
so right now it's a good time to explain what is a token and how does that come in play, and that is kind of like one of the new hot things to do.
Well, I don't think that you have enough time in your program to talk about everything
just kind of broad brush
tokens. Yeah. But long story short is tokens are kind of this new anomaly that have derived from all of the cryptocurrency and Bitcoin talks, and I think everyone has probably heard the phrase cryptocurrency or Bitcoin, but very few people kind of know what they are and what they do. And it's a loaded question. But tokens are pretty much broken up into two, maybe you call it three different categories. And one would be what you would call utility tokens, which is saying that this thing that I'm giving you has some sort of utility. Like, so it's a license to purchase a product, or it gives you the opportunity to enter into a marketplace that only those holders can have.
It's your ticket to ride or get through the door for something.
Right. Whereas non-utility tokens, which kind of an offshoot of that, would be what you think of traditionally as kind of your cryptocurrency type tokens, are those that there's no real utility or use to them other than...
we've all agreed they have some value and I want some.
Right. And so, you know, that you look at your traditional kind of supply and demand type models and you say, hey, like, we basically self-created this thing that we're all saying has value. And it goes up and down depending on who says it has value and who's willing to pay for it.
So in common practice, essentially someone is creating their own dollar, their own euro, whatever, and everyone's agreeing to exchange that and use that as a means of exchange.
Right. It's a bartering system.
It's just a representation of, I'm going to say this dollar is worth that cup of coffee. And as long as everyone agrees that dollar is worth it, or that token, or that cryptocurrency, or that Bitcoin is going to represent that exchange of value, then we're fine. And but they're not really backed by anything other than our perception of value and our agreement that they have value. They're not on a gold standard. There's nothing out there that's going to say it really is a dollar's worth of gold.
Generally, yes. I mean, there are some cryptocurrencies out there right now that are backed by traditional fiat currencies. But for the most part, that's right. I mean, but what folks have done who are much smarter than me and much, you know, have, you know, basically changed the space is basically, you know, looked at, okay, well, you know, if we look at the U.S. dollar right now, I mean, what is it backed by? It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. Well, what does that mean, right? And so
I won't make a political comment at this point, but that's true. I mean, it used to be on a gold standard. So when we had a dollar, that meant somewhere there was at least a certificate representing the gold for that dollar value. And now it's just everybody's trust in the system that the United States would not default on the value of the dollar.
Right. And that's why if you look at foreign currency markets, you know, if a, you know, if a political figure makes a comment, either positive, implied positively or negatively, like that can positively or disparately affect what's the intrinsic value of the dollar marked against
the exchange rate.
Right.
Yeah.
And so
like Venezuela right now has bucketfuls, wheelbarrowfuls of currency because no one believes in the value behind backing that currency.
Right. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, we're really simplifying.
Right. But, you know, in essence, that's what it is. And so what you've seen and what we've seen with some companies really within the past year is trying to employ alternative mechanisms for funding, which traditionally what you would think about as funding would be, okay, I can, you know, raise debt or some sort of convertible debt. So it's debt that converts into equity at some point, which 20, 30 years ago was kind of the new thing, right? Even though it probably always existed in some form or fashion for thousands of years. But like, we don't want to get into that. But then on the other end of the spectrum is your pure kind of equity financing, right? Which is, you know, hey, I think your company is worth $1,000, I'll give you $100 for 10% of your company,
right?
And so what businesses have started doing now, which is what you've heard of these ICOs or token sales. ICOs are initial coin offerings. Is what they said is, well, I don't really want to give up the equity piece, right? But what I'm selling you isn't really, it's not really equity, but it's not like, it's not really debt. So I'll create this alternative mechanism, which is a token, right? And so then if you look at that, the token that you're selling to someone can either be something that I'm selling you, something that is a utility token that allows you, you know, a license, right? And so, but that license, depending on the value of my company, could either be much more valuable or much less valuable, right? And so, you know, if you think of a silly scenario, like look at Chuck E. Cheese, right?
Right.
And Chuck E. Cheese, you cannot use like quarters. Well, I don't know. I haven't been to Chuck E. Cheese in like 20 years. But like you have to use a Chuck E. Cheese token to do that, right?
Right.
But, you know, the thought is that if I use that Chuck E. Cheese token and I buy it right now, you know, like there is a future value to that Chuck E. Cheese token. So if someone were to have bought 100 Chuck E. Cheese tokens in 1992,
right,
I bet you that they only paid, I don't know, I'm just making this up, but $10 for that.
Right.
If you went into Chuck E. Cheese right now, you know, it might be $100, you know, to buy the same tokens. And well, that's
something everybody might be more familiar with is the forever stamp at the post office.
Right.
Right. So if I bought 3,000 rolls when it first came out, I probably paid 40 cents a stamp. Now it's like closer to 60 cents a stamp or whatever it is. I always buy forever, so I don't really don't know. But that's the type of thing. It's still good and tradable, transactionable, usable. The utility is still there for that forever stamp, whether it was bought 20 years ago when they first started or they were bought yesterday. But the price I paid is what differs.
Yeah. And so what has been able to happen with blockchain technology in the past 4 or 5 years, and it's still kind of really rapidly developing, is
really rapidly.
Yeah. And the like the drawback to the Chuck E. Cheese token or the forever stamps is that, like, yeah, theoretically, like, you could sell me a forever stamp, or I could sell off my Chuck E. Cheese tokens or whatever I want to do, right? But there's not really a market for it. And it's really difficult to track that. It's difficult to track the purchase of it. It's difficult to track who owns it,
right,
when did they own it, etc. Well, like, one of the things that blockchain technology does is creates kind of a decentralized ledger system. And it allows you to have, you know, a unique ID or unique code every single time that a transaction occurs on the network. And really, one of the big benefits to that is what you've done now is you have injected liquidity into an illiquid market. And liquidity is the thing that allows your supply and demand, you know, chain to really drastically take off, because, you know, it could be plus 100 one day, minus 100 the next day, etc. And so what companies have been doing recently is they've been saying, huh, can I capitalize on that? And so I don't really have to sell equity of my company, and I don't really have to issue debt. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and sell licenses for these things that hopefully, you know, have some sort of utility. And then I let third parties trade them, you know, on a blockchain ledger, and they can determine what's the price of the license. So if it costs, I don't know what it costs anymore, but, like, you know, think of your Amazon Prime membership license. You know, it's $70 a year. Well, you know, what if you own the license, then you could, you know, like, theoretically, and that lived on a blockchain and you were able to transfer it, you could transfer that. So if Amazon was doing great, then your license that you have, you're like, eh, but I, you're like, I want to watch all my movies on Netflix, so I'll sell it off, and the thing I bought for $70 now is worth $150. And then whenever Amazon has a negative press release or, you know, something else, and you know, their license value goes down to $20, I'll rebuy it, right? And so that's basically what it is, and what it allows Amazon or anyone, any other company to do is then they release the control of their pricing mechanism of certain aspects of their business.
Which never happens with Amazon, but
right.
That's where.
But the, so the one drawback to all of that then is then you have attorneys, regulators, government politicians, everyone getting involved, because then you're saying, this thing, I agree, it has some cool value, but it looks, it smells like a security, and we have laws around that. And, you know, we have consumer protection mechanisms. We have insider trading laws. We have all these.
We have state laws. We have federal laws.
Right.
We have exchange laws. We have all kinds of stuff.
We have international agreements with different, you know, member nations, et cetera. And so, you know, that's where it's probably a really good time to be an attorney in this space. But It's also, you know, one of those things that I think everyone's going to have to deal with and have to kind of work out those kinks. But that's what you do with every new
and
technology.
And we've had some of the regulators on the show but talking about some of this. But the concern is if it looks like a security, then it means it needs to be sharing information behind that. Again, about the business, about the viability, right? The going concerns, the financials, what are you promising? That kind of thing. And that's why the securities or the government, everybody wants to regulate something, is because there's a potential for fraud. So where is that balance between regulating it and saying, if you can convince somebody to pay you $100 for each one of your tokens, the market would normally say, hey, that's fine. It's, you know, you guys are sharing information. You're adults. You get to make that decision. But it's when somebody might be promising something that value is going to go up that the regulators start looking and say, smells like a security. I want to regulate it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, not to get too philosophical here, but, you know, it's the same thing, you know, we have in, you know, the United States of America, we have, our society is founded upon liberalism, right? And, you know, the fact that you and I can have differing opinions and, you know, we're able to voice our concern about that, but, like, there are certain restrictions to that, right? Like, you know, you can't say defamatory statements that, or you can't tell a whole crowd of people to, you know, go and chase Doug down with, you know, pitchforks down the road, right? There are certain limitations to that, right?
Sorry. I had to make one political comment. So, okay, sorry.
But so, you know, it's the same thing here where it's like, okay, well, there is tremendous value in opening up a new market for this.
Right.
But I think what a lot of regulators are trying to get their head around is how do we do that in a way that, which is always kind of their thought, is how does it protect the little guy, right? Or little
person,
right? And so, you know, that's the thing of, okay, well, I can't just sell you something and claim that it's going to make you a 10,000% return and then walk away and, you know, go hang out in the Cayman Islands for 3 weeks and not do anything about it. Well, then it was basically fraud, right? Is I induced you to pay me money for me not doing anything. And so I think that's always the concern that you have with that. So from a legal perspective, when we're going in and we're advising our clients and we're looking at that, you know, a lot of our questions are hinged around, okay, you say you want to do a token sale, why not do traditional equity? And we'll explain that to them. And then if they say, no, I still want to do a token sale, et cetera, then we'll say, okay, well, like, what does your token do? You know, is it an investment? So, because what we're doing on the back of our mind is we're trying to think, okay, like, is this really a security? Do we need to register it? Even if it is a token,
it can be
a security, right. Which, you know, the SEC has already told us. Or is it going to be something other than a traditional security? And if it's going to be what you call a non-security or a utility token, then we're going to have a lot more questions for you about what is the actual benefit other than investment that someone's going to have, you know, and then the other question is going to be, is, you know, what jurisdictions are you going to be regulated by, and all of those things.
Just that question. Well, you know, and a lot of the companies that have been coming recently, it's where are you doing business at, just as the business that you've set up. So, like, are you operating in Colorado, North Carolina, and California, or New York, Illinois, Florida? I mean, because the states all have a hand in it. And if you're going to say a lot of intrastate, like NC PACES Act things coming in, and saying, well, we don't have to obey with any of these other laws out here. We don't have to obey the federal stuff. Well, that's not quite true. Because you're in this context, and if you're trying to do multiple offerings as an entity, or if you've created three entities, one in each three state, thinking you can do interstate funding in three states with three related entities, that ain't going to fly anywhere either. So it's like making sure that the legal parts, just because you created three separate legal entities doesn't mean it's going to function as a separate legal entity if it's owned by all three people. We learned that under Obamacare and several other things.
Yep.
So you can't just falsely make three separate tax entities and legal entities and think, oh, I can do interstate funding in three states then and then just combine everything. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and what you run into is what you call jurisdictional arbitrage. And so, you know, depending on where's the state or where's the nation that you're, you know, dealing with, is they might have a different set of rules, a different set of laws that might be more or less favorable, you know, to your business and what it is. But, you know, the interesting thing about ICOs, token sales, is, you know, one of the other attractive benefits to it has been is individuals trying to solicit investments from your non-accredited. And
definition check, a non-accredited versus an accredited investor.
So it's basically a set of rules and regulations that are federally based, but most other jurisdictions, like in the EU, in the UK, et cetera, have something similar. But for here,
generally high net worth individuals that can afford to lose their money and are deemed more sophisticated and have certain net worth thresholds.
Right.
So versus people who can't afford to lose it.
Right. So it's either going to be high net worth individuals who either make, you know, a significant amount of annual income or have a significant amount of liquid assets, institutional investors or folks like that, and then larger corporations, which I think they have to have at least 5 million or so in assets or something like that. That's basically what an accredited investor is. And regardless of what you think of the logic coming from, you know, the federal government is that accredited investors are quote unquote more sophisticated and able to
have more discernment in making their decisions.
Yeah, or hire the right people to make those decisions for them, and they're able to, you know, absorb potential losses that they have. So the thought is that someone making $250,000-$300,000 a year, you know, if they lose a $2,000 investment, it's different than someone making $20,000-$30,000 a year, and that $2,000 may be what they're using to feed their family that week.
Right.
So that's basically the...
So if you want to gamble, go play on the stock market versus early stage or technology evolving companies. Right. So, because you can buy stock, but you can't invest in... as a non-accredited investor a lot of times.
Yep.
So why is it so attractive to the companies, and why is it the hot thing now for to be going towards tokens versus just doing a straight crowdfunding or, you know, looking for venture capital or angels? Why is it? Because Bitcoin's out there, and everybody sees what it's doing, and the utility of that was the anonymity of the people transacting and the transactions.
Right, so...
You can say, I don't know.
Well, it's partly fad, yeah. So you are right. I mean, it's, you know, walk down the street and, you know, say the name Bitcoin, and most people's heads will turn, and they'll have an opinion on it, even though most people don't really know what it is, right?
Right.
So partly it's that. Partly it is, and I don't want to imply any kind of ill intent, but... Like, it's a thinking that, oh, well, attorneys are expensive, advisors are expensive, there's a bunch of these rules and regulations I don't really understand when it comes to crowdfunding or securities offerings at all, so I'll just do a token sale and it'll be much cleaner and I can raise money and don't have to deal with all of that stuff, right? So it's part of that, which once you bring in attorneys and advisors and a lot of them will advise you differently on that. But
All of them will advise you differently on that.
Well, you know, you never know.
If they're transactional. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's partly that. And it's partly, you know, contingent upon, you know, one of the things you and I haven't really talked about at all is this new kind of decentralized business model in and of itself. So it might be that, too. So it might be, you know, hey, we just want to create and we want to let society or, you know, any users decide what they want in the product, right? Which is antithetical of everything that you've learned in any kind of business training.
Well, yeah, because it's, we're a society of tangibles. Even when it's a security, it's made tangible by, it's a stock share or it's a convertible note or it's a debt instrument or it's a royalty agreement. It's something there that's tangible related to a trademark, a patent, a business, a product, a service, a technology. That's something there. And we can somehow get our mind around what it is I'm exchanging money for, right? Mm-hmm. So if I buy a computer and I buy a Mac versus a PC, or if I go buy a car, yeah, they all have four tires, a steering wheel. They go, they take gas or fuel of some sort. It's something that we can define. Now, generationally, undefined things that are nebulous and on the internet might be more appealing to a generation that doesn't have those parameters of saying, I want to be able to see it, touch it, read it, define it, have parameters around it. And
yeah, I mean, it's... But it's also, it's, you can almost look at it as a wing of, or a vestige of, like, open source software technology, right? Is, like, before the open source, what came out in the mid, late 80s, you know, before that, you had closed source software, which was, you know, everyone viewed it as an IP protection. It was copyrighted. And folks said, you know what, like, there's some stuff in there that, yeah, it's all fine, but I don't really like. Can I just delete it? I don't need it, right? So programmers don't need, you know, the 30 different games that come on a, you know, new computer, right? You know, they don't need, as much as I love doodling on the Paint app, right? Programmers don't need the Paint app. So it's like, well, if I just want a computer to do this, can't I do that?
It's that customization.
Yeah. And so this is kind of that vestige of that where you're saying, hey, like, I'll develop something that's cool. Like, I'll develop a MacBook, right? And then once I develop it, like, I'll, you know, sell these tokens and then I'll let the users decide, like, do they really like that it comes in silver or do they want it to come in purple?
Right.
You know, do they want it to, how do they like the layout of the keyboard?
Even behind an open source type concept, so to look to a Red Hat or something, there's a business process. There's something of value that a business is going to create, even when they're using open source, that isn't open source.
Right.
They have to get an exchange of value, there has to be something proprietary there. There has to be something useful there. There has to be something there that allows the entity to retain a value that somebody wants to give them money for in exchange. And I think with a lot of the tokens, everybody kind of thinks, well, I'm getting away from that necessity of creating a value in exchange for that, right? It's that guy, I'm going to sell the tokens, everybody's going to get to determine what it is, and I am going to go onto that beach on Belize, but I'm going to Belize and not the Caribbean because Belize has no extradition. And they say, you know, it's like, it's that kind of thing. So the people that are going to be more likely to want to buy a token are different than the ones that would more likely want the security of a debt instrument, knowing that I'm going to get paid so much money every month and it's predictable, versus the volatility of the perceived value of a token that's getting defined by the market.
Right. And but one of the other things that I don't think I talked about is a lot of companies will choose to kind of look down an ICO or token path as a more attractive mechanism for international investors. So again, you still have, you know, my caveats there is you still have the same securities law issues. You still have, you know, all those other things that you would normally think about. But it's become a more attractive mechanism for internationals who normally wouldn't be investing in a traditional kind of crowdfunding.
So is it a terminology difference? And we really need to make a differentiation between an investor and a funder? If we have international funders versus an investor is coming in and from traditional nomenclature, getting some part of ownership or right to ownership or some portion of the pie right now versus a funder who's not expecting that part of that company that's producing it, but they're expecting something of value in exchange for that token, not necessarily part of the business. So
I mean, you could. I mean, you could, you know, you could define it however you want.
Because we don't, we have crowd investing and we have crowd funding too, right?
Yeah, but if you have a, whether you have an international funder or international investor, you know, the analysis is still true that, you know, is it a security offering that you're providing, et cetera? The added measure of your anti-money laundering, your OFAC compliance issues, all of those things really come, you know, come into play whenever you're doing that, where in the traditional crowdfunding source, you're really not looking at that. Most of that is, you know, hey, I'm a North Carolina company. I want to crowdfund my business. You know, I don't want, you know, just a few, you know, really rich folks handholding me, talking to me and
making, you know, demands on me.
Right. And so I want it open to the public, et cetera. So I'm going to do a traditional crowdfunding model. You know, and that has value in and of itself. But if it depends. If you want to raise, you know, a lot of money, if you want international exposure and stuff like that, that might be a route that you go. But again, in the legal world, it's like, we live in a world of hypotheticals and examples, but you know, it's always kind of fact specific and you know, to each individual deal, which is why, you know,
why there are lawyers and business advisors
and business advisors
and regulators. Well, we have just like 2 minutes left, and so Doug, I want to thank you for being on the show. And if someone is out there and they're thinking about raising funds, what's the first step they do when they call you?
If they're thinking about raising funds, most of it is we're going to ask them how much are they looking to raise and what are they willing to give up to raise that. And so it is great if you go out there and raise $100 million. But if you gave up 99% of your company to do that, like, you might have given up everything.
Right.
Right? And as opposed to if you come to us and you say, hey, I want to raise $100 million. And I say, okay, great. Well, what do you want to do with the money? And it's like, oh, well, I really only need $20,000 in order to launch my product, and then I'm good. You're like, well, why do you want to raise $100 million?
Because I can.
Yeah. And it's like, well, that's great. You can. But maybe the better path is to raise $20,000, get what you need. You maintain a lot more ownership in the company and a lot more control over what you're doing. And then at a later stage, if you really think that you need a heavier investment, then we'll talk. And so if someone comes into our office and asks us about that, that's what we're going to have the conversation with them is, you know, what's the amount of, you know, investment that you need right now to fit whatever your needs may be.
Well, Doug, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's Doug Covard at fourscorelaw.com. And Doug is an attorney with Fourscore Law and specializes in funding your business. I want to thank everyone for listening today. And I want to thank our sponsor and underwriter, James Verdonic, attorney with Ward & Smith, PA of Raleigh. And Jim's website is gatewaycapitalx.com. And until next time, everybody, stay focused on the important things.